Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Las Musas podcast. My name is Johnny Garzavilla, and I am the author of 1500 Miles from the Sun. Today, I'm joined by Terry Gatasus Jennings, Alda P. Dobbs, and Lakin Zaya Kemp. And on today's episode of Debut Diaries, the middle grade and YA edition, we'll be talking about ARCs, reviews, and trade publications. Terry, can you start us off by introducing yourself and telling us a little about your book?
Absolutely, Johnny. Thanks so much. I'm Terry Cabasus Jennings, and I'm the author of the Definitely Dominguita chapter book series. It's about a Cuban American third grader who has adventures while taking on the persona of characters in the classics that her abuela read to her as bedtime stories. There are four books in that series. Two came out in March. Another one is coming out in August, and the other in November. But since we're talking about arcs and reviews, I'm also going to share my experience with my next two books. Pauli Murray, the biography of a feminist and civil rights activist, which comes out in January. And La Casita de Esperanza, the Little House of Hope, which comes out in May from Holiday House, in May of 2022. Because right now I'm in the weeds of arcs, reviews, and trade publications with three different houses.
Perfect. I can't wait to hear more about that. Alda?
My name is Alda P. Dobbs, and my upcoming book, the September 14th, is a middle grade, historical fiction middle grade, and it's Barefoot Dreams of Petra Luna. And it's inspired by my great grandmother and her story of having to flee the Mexican Revolution and all its violence and seek the refuge of the United States back in 1913. And there's a follow-up book too coming up next year. It's entitled, and it follows Petra Luna's story as she has her family in the refugee camps that were established in the southwest border. And then it follows Petra to San Antonio, Texas in 1913, along with 30,000 other refugees, which changed the landscape of San Antonio. So hopefully they'll tie in really nicely.
I'm so excited for those. Oh my gosh. And Lakin.
Yeah, so my debut novel came out in April of this year. It's called Somewhere Between Bitter and Sweet, and it's a contemporary romance told in dual point of view. Pen is an aspiring pastry chef who dreams of continuing her father's cooking legacy, despite her parents having different plans. And Xander is living undocumented with his abuelo, both of them estranged from Xander's father, who he is desperate to find. When Xander starts working at Penn's family restaurant, their worlds collide. But when both the restaurant and Xander's immigrant status are threatened, he and Penn must work together to save the place they both call home.
Perfect. Literally one of my favorite books I've read this year. Right? It's so good. And again, I'm Johnny. I am Johnny Garzavilla. I am the author of the young adult novel, 1500 Miles from the Sun, which follows high school senior in Corpus Christi, Texas, Julian, AKA Jules Luna, who is just like trying to go through the low key senior year and like a last season of soccer and graduate and get into UCLA and finally be able to move away from Texas and like all of the things that have kind of constrained his sexuality there. But then it all kind of just like flies out the closet whenever he gets way too drunk one night and accidentally comes out as gay on Twitter. And in the days and weeks and months that follow, Jules will learn all about the good and the bad that happens whenever we let ourselves live authentically.
And so, that was another great book.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and get right into it. This first question we did kind of cover a little bit during our episode on covers. So if you haven't listened to that episode with Alda and I would highly recommend it because it's a great episode and I had a lot of fun doing it. But expanding on that, like when it comes to arcs, sometimes what you see on the cover and even inside in the interior, like isn't going to be what the final product looks like. And so I'm curious if any of y'all had arcs that had like temporary covers or designs, whether externally or internally, that ended up being different from the final look of your book?
Okay, this is Terry. Absolutely. In the Dominguita series, it's chapter book and it's illustrated. And I got the arc of the first book and every illustration had a sign on it that said, this is not final art. Now the cover was good, but eventually some of those ended up being final art, but they were still not all being final art. Now, the Pauli Murray book, which it's coming out in January. And actually, this is a really, it was supposed to have come out in November 2022, and they pulled it up to January 2022, which is doesn't normally happen. So I think we were trying to get, I happen to be working with the subject's niece, and we have hundreds and hundreds, 872 actually, family pictures. So the book will contain a lot of pictures, but the ARC, which is coming out in a couple of weeks, only contains pictures in one of the sections, one of the five sections. So kind of like, okay, you'll get the others when you spend the money and buy the book. And the cover, we had some, Rosita, her niece had some different, had some concerns about the cover. Polly were alive today, she would have been transgender. And that was the label that she would choose for herself. And the book was very feminine looking. And so we're still, that book is still in the cover's still in the process, but there's going to be a cover with the ARC. That is, my understanding is that it's not the final cover. So the book for Holiday House, I think it will be, it's a picture book. So I think picture books, you have a more of an idea that you kind of show more. It's more set when it finally comes out. But I was also told that it's not going to come out early.
I had ARCs, but didn't really change the cover, and it's not illustrated really. So nothing really changed from the ARC to what I have now. The only thing was, I think we discussed it in the covers, that I did get the initial sketch from my book cover, and just to get my input, my feedback. And I noticed that the fauna, the cacti they used was more of a Southwest Sonora type of cacti, which is really different when you cross a mountain over to Coahuila, the cacti look different. So I said, no, we got to change that just to make it more authentic. And yeah, they worked with me right away, and they put those beautiful cactus pads in there with the flowers. So yeah, they changed that. Other than that, everything was pretty much as is.
I'm wondering if there might be some listeners who don't know exactly what an ARC is. Some people call it an ARC. I've heard it referred to as advanced reader copies as well as advanced review copies, but basically it's just an early version of the book that your publisher will send out to get early reviews, create some early buzz. But like we've been talking about, it's not an exact, replica of what the final version will look like. Either the cover might be something that changes. For mine, it was a young adult novel, so my cover was pretty much set. But inside of the book, there were tons of typos and probably like little inconsistencies, things that we were still in the process of catching through the copy editing process. But your ARC is really, I think, ready to go out, like after maybe the first round of copy edits, sometimes after the first round of line edits. So inevitably it's going to have errors in it. So just keep that in mind. Like if you ever go to a conference or anything like that and you get access to an ARC, it's not going to be exactly the same as the final product.
Actually, I made a mistake. I thought you were just talking about illustrations, but there were missed typos and whatnot. I think a couple of them, but, one big thing that was changed, it was in the timeline in the back. They checked everything, one person went through and checked, fact checked the timeline. And there was one instance that I had mixed up the dates, and I'm glad they caught it, because otherwise it would have been embarrassing, the fact that something was labeled as one date and it wasn't, because it does impact the whole process or the war event. So They caught that, and I'm glad they fixed it for the real book when it comes out, or what do you call that? The hardcover book. So I'm glad, I'm grateful for ARCs.
One thing that happened to mine that just happened today actually was, and I'm not sure how this works for everything, but so this is the Polly Murray book is a nonfiction book. And today we got permission for some to include some of her poetry. And I don't know whether that will be, and that makes the book so much better, so much richer. But I don't know if it's going to be there. I don't know if that's going to be there, because we just did get the permission today. And I know those arcs are being, you know, printed right now. So we'll see.
No, yeah, I think that all just really encapsulates the fact that like arcs and like the entire process up until the book comes out is just like ever evolving and like a little chaotic. In my own case, the cover for 1500 Miles from the Sun with the physical arcs were not the final version of my book. And like, if you were here for the cover episode, I think I went into a little bit of detail about how that was kind of like an annoying part of the whole process. We like had been going back and forth about what the cover was going to look like and just small little details about everything. They had shown us like a second draft of the cover, and my agent and I had gone back to them about all the things that we just did not like about it and we wanted to change. And then that led to a conversation about, well, if you want the final cover on your arc, we're going to have to push your publication day back. And so you can pick to move your publication day back, but have the final cover on your arc, or you can have your pub date, but have a not final cover on your arc. And I was like, I don't really care about my arc, like it's whatever. So, and I'm not moving my publication date. So we didn't do that. But when I assumed that that would mean that my arc cover would end up just being some very basic, like maybe like a sun or something on it and just call it a day, it ended up being like that second draft of the cover that I had just gotten done talking crap about, like right there on it, and which did not make me happy. Like in no way was I ever close or had a connection with like my arc unboxing or like the arc showing up. It's like, okay, like they're here, let me just get them out as soon as possible, because like that ain't mine. So yeah, like in my case, like the final art was definitely not the, like the design of it was not even inside, like the chapter headings are a little different. But yeah, so like definitely just a lot of changes. I mean, probably not huge changes, but still changes that like made the book, I think the cover like looks great now. And I think like I would have, that would not have been necessarily the case if we had just let the art cover be the final cover. So when it comes to like reviews and like trade publications and like seeking out other people to like view your work, did your publisher ever talk to you about the outlets and the people that they were sending your arcs to, whether it's like media and news outlets or trade reviewers or bookish people, et cetera?
No, for the chapter book series, and again, we gotta remember chapter books may be different. I'm just saying that because they have been for me, but I did not get an awful whole lot of arcs sent out by the publisher. They had, and this was in the height of the pandemic, and they were trying to get out, you know, all these other really important books. And I totally understand that. I had the opportunity, they sent a few arcs, but then I received about 25 arcs, and then I had unlimited e-arcs. So I don't feel like it was, that I had a bad situation. I sent the arcs to the people that were the most important. So it was good to have a list ahead of time of the people that I wanted to send arcs to. And then the e-arcs were wonderful, because anybody that, you know, that was willing to read an e-arc, and some people aren't, but I was able to get my book out. So that was good.
Yeah, no, for me, after I signed the contract to get the book published, I started doing research about, and I kind of knew already because I had followed bloggers and book reviewers. So I started finding information about them, doing more research, asking other authors, and trying to see about their submission process and just making note of it, making a list. And once I had the marketing meeting, my marketing team at Sourcebooks told me what their plans were for the arcs, who they were going to send them to, but I also brought in a list and said, hey, I'm considering these people too, do you mind? And some of them, you know, overlapped with people they knew. And some of them, they said, yeah, no, that's great. You know, we'll consider them. So it was a collaboration. And I think that helped too, to get the book out there a little more. So, and yeah, that's how the arcs were distributed by the research I did, and then the marketing team.
My publisher did not share this information with me beforehand, which was probably in some ways for the best in terms of my mental health, because then I couldn't stalk these different outlets and entities to see if or when they were going to post a review of the book. But at the same time, I do think it's important for authors, especially midlist authors or authors who aren't getting a lot of support from their publisher, to inquire about this. Because if your publisher isn't planning on submitting your book to trade reviewers, that's a big problem. Because there are many libraries that will search the trade publications for books with starred reviews and prioritize buying those. So you're at a huge disadvantage if your publisher isn't even sending books to those reviewers. I know of another 2021 debut author whose publisher didn't submit her book to any trade publications for review. And when she realized how detrimental that was for her book, she and her agent went back and demanded that they send her book to trade reviewers, even though the book was already out. But it was worth it to put that pressure on her publisher because of how big of an impact trade reviews can have on libraries stocking your book.
And something I'd like to ask just before I forget is, I've heard that there's five trade reviews that... Yeah, there's a Kirkus, the Booklist, Junior Library Guild, Bookshelf, I believe.
Kirkus, School Library Journal, Booklist, Publishers Weekly, and
I can't think of that last one either.
Yeah. Yeah, I know some, and I hear, but I could never remember.
Those four.
Yeah, and some of them are more difficult to get starred reviews from than others. Some of them have a bad reputation for microaggressions, which we'll talk about later in this episode. So they're all very different. And the thing is, it's not necessarily like a small pool of reviewers who do all of the reviewing. It's actually a really large and diverse pool of people. So sometimes you might get paired with a reviewer who is 100% not your target audience. So there's a big element of luck in terms of getting a starred review as well.
Oh yeah.
My agent said that my book was sent to all those places, and I only got a review from Kirkus. I didn't get even reviewed. So I've just wondered whether they did actually send them or not. Because it's done really well. So despite that, but I always wondered that.
Yeah, and that's the thing too. There's a lot of reviewers out there, blogs and whatnot. So it's word of mouth. You know what I mean? If you don't get those, but you get the other reviews, just try to aim as many and try to make the connections. And word of mouth usually ends up, you know, it helps a lot as well.
And that kind of like leads into like, we definitely did have like a list of like national, regional, and local media that they'd be sending ARCs to, and like Latinx and queer media that they were going to be in contact with. And like, I remember seeing like the San Antonio Express News and a San Antonio Current on the list, and was like just super excited about like local like people getting access to my book and being able to read it and talk about it. And they also list, I think, every single trade reviewer. I've gotten reviews from, publicly three, but I think by the time this episode comes out, it'll be four. So I think they reached out to everyone, which I think was a huge deal, because like y'all said, like there's just, especially with my publisher, I don't have the reach that like a lot of other publishing houses do. So to be able to get that sort of attention from trade journals, I think makes a huge difference when it comes to like libraries and booksellers, of like independent bookstores and librarians and educators. But there was also, and I think we may have mentioned this before, like multiple people, but there is like a list of Latinx book bloggers and booktubers that like we do have access to. And I made sure that my publisher knew like, hey, we're gonna prioritize these people if you do any sort of outreach. Like I need to know that these Latina book bloggers and booktubers are going to have like first dibs on any physical ARCs. So that was something that I clearly communicated to them. And even now, it's still going. Like we had the Texas NPR ask us for a copy a couple weeks ago. So like, it's a continual process even after the book comes out, of just like people learning about your book and then attention just kind of like gradually but consistently being there. And speaking of that, did any of y'all do a blog tour? And if so, was it something that you put together yourself, or was it handled by your publisher?
No, I did not do, I do not do a blog tour. And, you know, I did have for the second, for the Pauli Murray book, for the biography, I did have a 1 hour meeting with their publicity and they're going to do an awful whole lot. And I don't remember them mentioning a blog tour, but they did mention things like me writing articles for newspapers and magazines about Pauli Murray. And so I'm thinking that it's more because it's a nonfiction title that they would like the articles rather than a blog tour. I don't know, but if I had wanted to for the chapter books, it would have been all on my own. And I don't think that they have mentioned that for the Pauli Murray book.
For me, it hasn't launched yet. It doesn't launch until September. So I haven't done any type of blog tours. And I guess right now that we're hoping for an in-person book launch, we're keeping our fingers crossed, you know, but they're on the fence, you know, with that Delta variant, you know, they don't know what it's going to look like 2 months from now. So it's probably something I should start considering just in case as a backup, you know, start getting information because I haven't been told anything about a blog tour. So I got to learn more about that and start researching it looking into it just to better prepare, have it as a backup.
So first, I think the idea of the traditional blog tour has evolved a lot, and now publishers are targeting creators who primarily create videos. So I think that's something important to keep in mind, that a lot of that time and energy that authors and publishers used to put towards the big blogs, they're now putting towards TikTokers, Bookstagrammers, people like that. When I used to self-publish, I went the blog tour route a few times, but it's really tough to make it worthwhile. You've got to appear on blogs with a really large, really engaged following, and there just aren't a significant number of those, especially not anymore. So it's a huge amount of time and labor, especially if each blog's feature is a little different. So maybe you're answering interview questions for some of them and writing guest posts for others. You're usually creating a lot of original content for a blog tour. And like I said, not all blogs are created equal. So you might be spending a lot of time writing a guest post for a blog that doesn't get very much traffic. And that's time that you could have spent writing. So when bloggers started reaching out to my publicist early on about my debut novel, I went ahead and told her that I was not interested in doing a blog tour or any blog specific publicity for the book. I did make time to be interviewed on a few blogs by Latinx creators, but that was it. And I think my time was much better spent being interviewed by like NBC Latino and being featured in Kirkus and targeting those bigger publications. But I also know that that's not an option for everyone. So if you are thinking about planning a blog tour, I would say definitely get your publicist involved to handle the scheduling and all of the logistics if you can. And then to save yourself some time, keep copies of all of your answers and guest posts in a single document and reuse what you can for each post. Also, I would focus your attention on blogs with engaged followers, meaning people are frequently commenting on posts and sharing them. And then to fill out your tour, also make sure, like Johnny said, that you're including bloggers from marginalized backgrounds and ideally bloggers who share the identity of your characters, because you might also help that blogger grow their platform a little bit in the process. And that's always a good thing. And then if you don't want to take on the responsibility of a blog tour like I did not, then you don't have to. I don't think it will necessarily hurt you to put your energy somewhere else.
Yeah, I think, and especially if it's going to be something that you're going to have to take care of yourself, finances are going to be a huge thing that you should consider too. We were approached multiple times by different book blog tours who wanted to highlight my book. But if it was going to be something that I was going to do myself, it was going to come out in the thousands of dollars to pay for these book bloggers' time and efforts. And like, yeah, like that's, it's great. But like, also if you don't have the money, like that's also a very valid thing. We definitely like told my publisher and my publicist, like every single time we were approached by a blog tour, like, hey, this one or that one like is interested in doing a tour with our book. Like, what do y'all think? Can you get in contact with them? Ultimately, we did have a blog tour that was mainly like maybe even solely through Instagram, with the TLC book tours. And I did have a conversation with my publicist when they let me know about it, because again, I was interested in like specifically Latinx or queer or QTBIPOC outreach for the tour, and like what like their tour generally looked like. Like I wasn't interested in a tour that was gonna be like the Instagrams of a bunch of like older white straight people. Like that wasn't my audience. That wasn't who I would prefer like getting a copy of my book, if I could choose who gets a copy of my book at all. So like there is that, like if you're gonna do it like and you want an emphasis in there, be sure to just like speak your mind and like make sure that your publicist knows exactly what you want and what you're going to get out of this tour, especially if you're gonna have to be putting in effort yourself. Luckily, I haven't had to, like I just get tagged in Instagram posts like 3 times a day from really cool people who like are doing giveaways and whatnot. So like that's been pretty hands-off. But also like, and I think it's important to not only reach out to your publisher about those kinds of things, but it's also important, like if you have other, even like Latinx authors who you can reach out to who might've worked with or heard about a specific blog tour and what their experiences were with them, it'd be great to ask them, because like, while so many are fantastic and doing great work and getting our books onto the lives of people who might not have otherwise ever known about us, ultimately they can and like have been unsafe spaces for marginalized writers. So like if a book tour approaches you or if your publicist approaches you about a book tour, definitely take some time and see if you can get other people's experiences with that book tour and see how it fits you and your own experience and identities. And our next question, and I think Terry touched on this a little bit, but like if you want to expand for sure, like I'm for like very much inviting you to. Did you get, or yeah, I think in all of us, like did y'all get physical ARCs? If so, did you get a lot of them? Did you get like 3 or 4? And like what did you do with the ARCs once you got them?
So yeah, Johnny, what I did with my ARCs was I made a cute little stationery with the picture of my little Dominguita. And I always wrote a nice note saying what, you know, here's my baby. And I would love it if you like it, if you could, blah, you know, write a review or whatever. And thanks so much for what you're doing. I always thought that the personal note was good. And I did get right many, but a lot of what I sent out was e-ARCs.
I got about, I want to say 10 ARCs, and 2 of them right away, my kids grabbed from the box as I opened it and they took off with them. So I said, okay, 2 of them are gone, you know, but my 9-year-old was wanting to read the book. I had not let her read at all. And I told her I was going to wait until I got the ARC. So yeah, she grabbed one and gave it to her. And now the other 8, I used them to give them to librarians that I had made friends with or that I was close to here in the area, and hand, you know, delivered them and here in the Houston area and some in San Antonio, and signed the note, just like Terry said. I think that goes a long way when you handwrite a note to a librarian. And I did that. And then some of them were for reviewers. I mailed a couple of them too. So yeah, they were gone pretty quick.
For my debut novel, I got about 30 physical ARCs, which was a really nice surprise, because at the time, lots of other debut authors were being told by their publishers that they would only be getting e-ARCs due to all of the printer issues caused by the pandemic. And then I was surprised again when I recently got 25 ARCs of my sophomore novel, despite the fact that many publishers decided to do away with physical ARCs permanently after seeing the money that they could save by sticking with e-ARCs. But every time I get ARCs, I'm always sort of stumped at first about what to do with them. I think it definitely helps to sit down and make a list of how many need to go somewhere versus how many I can play around with. For example, I always give one to my mom and I give one to my grandparents. And then I circulate, you know, 5 or 6 copies among other authors, including members of Las Musas who want to read the book and other 2021 debuts who'd like to read. And each one of those readers usually sends the book on to someone else so I can get plenty of reads without giving up too many copies. And I do the same thing with local teachers and librarians that I know. And then I usually use some for giveaways. And then it's always important to remember to keep a couple for yourself for posterity.
Something else I also forgot. It's just the mommy brain here. I got back from a road trip. I traveled to Alabama and then drove down through the coast down I-10. And I told my publisher that, and they ended up sending me about 20 ARCs. And so I told them I was gonna stop at the bookstores. So I did that. I made it a point to stop at every bookstore that was on my way there and just dropped off an ARC, talked to the bookseller, you know, try to do it ahead of time, made the connection. You know, some of them answered, some of them didn't, but we'll see. We'll see if that works out, if it pays off or not. But it was a lot of work, but it was really fun because I just to see different bookstores at every stop and seeing some of them were almost, one of them was in Florida and they were so packed, you know, it was right by the beach and Sundog Books. And it was just nice to see people back into buying books and just hanging out by the beach, reading books from that bookstore. So it was great. So I was grateful for those ARCs, but you know, you never know. Just ask your publisher what your plans are and we may surprise you.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that. I asked for more ARCs because there was a point that I found that there were some other folks that I wanted to send ARCs to. And my publisher was very, very, you know, wonderful about it. They did some folded and gathered, what they call F&Ds. And I got them fairly quickly. And I think I got about 10 more because they responded when I had a need. Now, I want to make a comment about the chapter books. I got ARCs for chapter book number one. I have not gotten ARCs for any of the others and will not. It's just the first one. The others, your publicity is pretty much on your own.
Can I ask, like, yeah. You got like no ARC at all, even e-ARCs of the next one?
Zero.
Wow.
But I think it's normal. I also think that's normal.
Yeah, I've heard that for series as well.
But that's good to know. Like, I'm sure there's people here who are interested in like chapter books or like even middle grade series or something who should probably not have to get their hopes up for ARCs for books two or three. So for me, I think I got 10 ARCs, 10 physical ARCs. And like a few went to authors who had expressed interest in reading my book, but most of them went to like bookstagrammers and book bloggers. I had created this this ARC interest Google form, like specifically for Latinx or like QTBIPOC, like book people who could fill it out and like let me know like if you want an e-ARC or if you would prefer a physical ARC, and like with the asterisk that like, I don't know how many ARCs I'm getting. Like if you tell me e-ARC, I can give you that. But if you tell me physical ARC, I can't make any promises. But like I still had that. And then from there, I was able to like go through the submissions of those and see like which ones would benefit me the most as far as like reach and audience and how many subscribers and followers they have, especially with like bookstagrammers. I really wanted to send my ARC to them and that way they could have it and show it off. But that's kind of how I dispersed it. Literally any of them who wanted an e-ARC, I would just go send the link to. And even after I had sent out all of my 10, like if there were other like book bloggers or booktubers or anyone who I was really friendly with or familiar with who wanted an ARC, I would tell my publicist, like, you don't have to send me more ARCs, but send them an ARC. Like they need an ARC. They fit like the category that we're looking for to read it. So either way, like even if you have a small number of ARCs, like I think all of you who said, like, make sure to just tell your publicist or your publisher, like, give us more ARCs. If not me, then give the people more ARCs. Like, let's get more readership, more reviews, and more attention for this book beforehand.
Huge. Yeah, I think one thing that you might want to, that we need to understand, among other things, is what position your book has within that publishing house. You know, if you're a little fish in a big pond, you may not get a whole lot of stuff. They will do what you ask them to do. But if you're one important book in a smaller house, you may get a lot more attention. And you know, for the Polly Murray book, they asked me, you know, for my dream list, and they had a list of their own for ARCs, and we'll see what happens. But I think it's going to be, it's different.
And just like ARCs as a thing in general is just constantly evolving, especially since COVID has started. So our experience with our first book and ARCs is probably going to be different than our second and third and fourth books, like, and how ARCs work or whether or not they exist physically or not. So like, we'll see. And it'll be an interesting conversation to have in a couple years from now. But moving on, at what point did you start getting your trade reviews, and who shared those with you? Were they like your publicist? Was it your agent who was in charge of like getting you that information?
I had a publicist for the chapter book series, but that publisher was not engaged in with my book. I got the one Kirkus review, and thank God it was a starred review, but that was the only one. And I heard it from my editor. Also, it was an Amazon editor's pick, and I did hear that from my editor. But, you know, I did not get an awful whole lot of other things. We'll see what happens with the Polly Murray book and the Holiday House picture book. But for the chapter book, not much.
For me, it was my editor who did it, who came to me, and we're really close, and I love her. It's Wendy McClure. And she's the one that brought the good news to me about the reviews. And right after that, usually the publicist is the one that send the email saying, hey, yay for the review and whatnot, later on my agent and all that. But my editor is the first one to give me that nice news.
My editor was also the one to email me every time a trade review came in, and she usually had access to it before it actually went live. So I'd get to see it a few days or sometimes even a week before everyone else. I remember when I got my first starred review from Kirkus, I was like, so what's a star? Like, I don't really understand what this means. And it is actually kind of confusing because on retailer sites, the best review that you can get is 5 stars and the worst review you can get is 1 star. But with trade reviews, it's either 1 star or nothing. So my editor and agent had to explain to me that getting a starred review is actually really special and something that's really difficult to do. But initially I wasn't all that excited because I didn't understand the implications of a starred review and what it meant for my book. Obviously, now that I understand, I'm super grateful that Somewhere Between Bitter and Sweet has gotten 2-starred reviews, because like I mentioned earlier, that just increases the chances that libraries and bookstores will stock it. But on the other hand, it also adds this new level of pressure for my sophomore book, because what would it mean if my debut got starred reviews and my next book doesn't? Like, that's a little scary to think about. But like we always talk about on this podcast, every achievement and every milestone that you reach in publishing just moves the goalposts farther and farther away from you, because you're constantly working towards the next thing. So if you get a negative trade review, maybe the goal becomes getting a positive trade review. And if you get a positive trade review, maybe the goal is then to get a starred review. And if you get one, then you want 2, and so on and so forth, until, I don't know, either you break down or somehow learn how to manage all of those expectations. But starred reviews are definitely a double-edged sword, I think.
As someone who like really loves being the best at everything and just has a huge problem with being bad at anything I ever do ever, like, starred reviews are super important to me. I was like, I need some starred reviews. I need to see some stars. And like, stars are weird. Like, the ranking and like how stars work are very different than like what one would see in like Goodreads or Amazon or Barnes and Noble or like retail sites. I tend to think of it like, if like you're familiar with like culinary world at all, like I think of them as like Michelin stars. Like, oh, you're just like a Michelin star writer now. You have 1 or 2 or 3 Michelin stars now. Like, look at you. So that's kind of like how the perspective that I put it in. I got my first trade review, I think like beginning of April, a couple months before my book came out. And that was from Kirkus, and that was a starred review. And then I got a couple more like mid-May. One of them was a starred review. And then I I'm just going to assume that by the time this podcast comes out, I'll have been able to tell everyone that I got another star review. It's not public when we're talking about it right now, but like when it, and maybe I won't have been able to tell people publicly, but if I did, I just told you all now. So oops. Even like after publication date, like you can still get trade reviews and like attention and things. And so, I've been very lucky to have like 4 really good reviews and 3 of them stars. And like now I'm frightened because like, well, I guess my second book's got to get 4 star reviews, but we'll see how that goes. It's just kind of been a continual thing. I guess this might be my last one that I get. I don't know. We'll see. But like, don't expect them all to come before your pub date. Like if you don't hear from Kirkus by the time you're published, like it's okay. Don't freak out. Like maybe they're not ignoring you. Like maybe you're gonna get it in a month from now. So it's just all what their availability looks like ultimately.
Yeah, and that's, I wanted to add to that about not freaking out, because that's something I started doing, being ultra competitive as well, you know, wanting those stars, and it's an adrenaline rush you get, you know, and you become like a junkie. You want that, but you got to focus, because it takes away that energy from your writing, from your creative, you know, you start doubting yourself. If you get it, you start doubting yourself because, okay, what if I don't get it next time? If you don't get it, then you start doubting yourself at this moment. And so it's just, okay, it is what it is. You get it, you know, you don't get it, you know, move on. Just be grateful for, you know, if they looked at your book and reviewed it, great. You got to start, that's great too, but focus on task at hand and not freaking out. Because yeah, it's easy to just get into that cycle of just constantly checking, or what can I have done to get that star review? Because like Lakin, you said earlier, it's that one person that read your book and gave you that review. You have no idea what mood they were in at that moment, or how they viewed your book at that time, you know. Or so, you know, just take it for what it is and just focus on the next book.
Yeah, like anything that comes with reviews, if you know yourself to be kind of hypercritical the moment you get any kind of criticism, it's probably best just not to look at it, like, or just like take everything as good as it is or as bad as it is with a grain of salt, and just like let yourself go do the thing. Ultimately, that's what you're getting paid for. You're not getting paid to get reviews. You're getting paid to write a book. So like, just concentrate on your desk and like keep on going. It'll be fine. You're going to do great. Even if people don't think so, you're going to do great. Because, you know, what does Kirkus know? So before we get into the next couple of questions, I do want to, like, just touch on, because they deal with reviews and reviewers, that these don't necessarily mean, like, we're talking about actual, like readers who review books in, like, certain spaces. We're not going to talk, we're going to talk primarily about trade reviewers, about like Kirkus, SLJ, Booklist, people like that. And ultimately, like, I guess the people that you're going to at any point pay somewhat of attention to, and just like stress that, you know, it's author space versus reviewer space. And you know, it's important to keep that distinction there. It's important, like, if you are a hypocritical person, go delete Goodreads off of your phone immediately, and just let that be. And like, not only like for the well-being of your readership to know that like they don't have an author just constantly looking at the reviews and the thoughts of their book, but for you yourself, and to just have that sort of respect equally of like, okay, I'm not going to get into your space, so like don't come into mine, and like let's just sort of keep that separate. If you're not paying me to write a book and I'm not paying you 15% of my work to do anything critical about my work, like I don't need to hear about it. So like in that regard, we're just like, if y'all feel like you want to expand any on like reviewer space versus writer space, and just like having a healthy relationship with readers as it pertains to reviews, definitely feel free to like elaborate. Otherwise, we'll get into the next questions.
I would just add something that's sort of related to this, is that there are quite a few reviewers who maybe have a blog or an Instagram or a YouTube channel where they review the books that they read. And at a certain point, they, you know, maybe write a book themselves and they get a book deal and they become an author and become a public figure. And I know some of those authors make sort of a moral and ethical decision to discontinue reviewing books at that point, because you're basically reviewing your peers. And then there are some authors who continue it and continue reviewing books by their peers. I would just warn that that's another sort of gray area that can get a little messy. And that if you're in that space right now where you are a blogger or you are a reviewer, but your ultimate dream is to become an author, and that's why you're such a voracious reader, and that's why you're so passionate about the community, then, you know, I would just be aware of that overlap and how it can be tricky to navigate.
That's good information.
No, I was just thinking that one of the things that we do though, as authors, as debut authors, is review each other's work. And again, I agree with Johnny that that needs to be an aside thing, but I think it's very good that we give each other, you know, a boost. And, you know, you need to be honest, but then we're also putting that book out there, giving that book more attention. So I think that's a good thing to continue to do.
Yeah, and I wasn't necessarily like bringing that up to discourage people from going one way or the other, or, you know, saying that it's not moral or ethical to review the books of your peers. But me personally, like, I would just think twice if I'm an author and I'm gonna post publicly criticism of someone else's book. Right. But this is different. What we're talking about in terms of like what we do as part of Las Musas, we do boost each other's books. We do rate and review on Goodreads sometimes and other retailer sites. But that's different because, you know, none of us would ever like purposely post a one-star review of a fellow Musas book. That's not how that dynamic is set up. And that's not the purpose of like sharing our arcs with each other or of sharing our books with each other.
I think that would also just be a really interesting conversation to have just in general about how like you as a reader and as someone who like puts your thoughts out into the world, a very valid thoughts regardless of like what you think of a book becomes different when you become a writer, and how like you kind of have to consider what you say, especially if like maybe you just don't enjoy a book by a specific author who you do really enjoy spending company with, and how that can get kind of weird. And like maybe like once you become an author, like you kind of have to think about transitioning from a review space to your group chat and like letting people know about certain like thoughts and opinions. Again, valid, like you can have any opinion on any book and it's completely valid, but like just where you let yourself say these things to people can change when you start becoming an author, especially in traditional publishing. And like, you know, that's just something to consider.
Right. Yeah, and I just know that the purpose of this podcast is, you know, we're trying to provide information for people who want to be authors. And I just know there's a lot of aspiring authors who also are in those spaces.
That's a good point. Because I remember one time a while back reading an article that said, if you're a writer and you wanted to give a rating to somebody, you know, make sure it's a 4 or 5 star, you know, don't, even if you didn't like it, don't even put that 1 star or that 3 star, just walk away and don't say anything, you know, because it's your fellow writer and you just, it's hard. It's really hard to write, you know, so, you know, just, we got to support each other.
That's all super helpful information, I think, for anyone listening. But now we'll go ahead and get into the next questions, and these solely pertain to like trade reviews. I would love to know like what has been your favorite review of your book so far, or even just like your favorite like portion of a review that you've gotten from a trade reviewer, like anything like that.
My favorite review was my only review. But what I liked about it is that that person totally got my book. That was it. See, he or she just knew exactly what I meant, what my book was was saying and what my little girl was doing. So that was it.
I've gotten two reviews. Hopefully I'll get more, but those two reviews were wonderful. They're from Booklist and Kirkus, and the Booklist ones were the start, and not the Kirkus one, but just the way what they each reader saw from the book and the way they express themselves about the character, about Petraluna. And it was just very moving to see two minds just seeing the book from different angles and coming up with their own opinion. But it was just beautiful how they stated that in their own words. And they write so beautifully, you know, it's just, wow, this is actually what they're talking about, you know, about my book. So it was an honor. And I like them both. I like them both a lot. I couldn't tell you which one I like, if I like one more than the other. So
again, coming from, you know, many years of self-publishing where you get a ton of not only unsolicited feedback, but also, you know, I was still growing in my skills and my abilities. And so when I wrote crap, people told me and had no problem telling me. So I've kind of created this habit for myself where I really don't internalize reviews that much. So, you know, I thought about, before answering this question, I thought about going back and reading them because I really couldn't remember the details. And I was like, no, I actually don't want to do that. because I think what really means the most to me is those like private messages that you get from readers. Those aren't exactly reviews, but it's still feedback. And it's just those kinds of things that really help keep me going on days when the writing is really hard. The trade reviews, I feel like, are just bonus that I try not to think too much about because of all the reasons that we listed earlier.
No, yeah, I completely get that. And like, I feel very fortunate to have gotten just like really positive and affirming reviews from trade journals. I feel like I went back to my website because it has like at least the pull quotes of like what they said about my book. But I think like this newest one that I have from Booklist is probably my favorite, because they mentioned like the need in LGBTQ+ literature for like more Latinx characters and voices, and even more so like romantic relationships between two BIPOC characters. Like that in itself, I think, like speaks a little bit more than what I feel a lot of readers are hopeful for. Like, you know, we read a lot of, especially even in like BIPOC literature, like there's always going to be like the white savior or the white romance like character that the person of color falls for, or the white best friend who like ends up saving the main character. And so like to really have it spoken to of just like, yeah, like we recognize that like this book is presenting something that where there's a gap in literature, I think was really important that like someone says it, if I'm not going to, which I will, but like, you know, if someone else can say it, that'd be great. And so that was nice to hear from them.
I just wanted to piggyback on Lakin when she talked about just regular reviews too, because I do like those trade reviews, but my two favorite ones, more so than the trade reviews, were from two girls that had blogs. One of them was Bridget in the Books, and the other one is Reading with Valerie. And they're 12-year-old girls, you know, that read my books, which is the intended audience. And just to get that feedback from them, and one of them's a video, and just to hear that excitement in her voice, you know, she's a young girl too. And it's just wonderful. That fulfills me so much more than, you know, any other trade review or whatnot. Just seeing that young voice coming across with that enthusiasm, it's really nice. It's really good.
That's something really important to point out too in this conversation, is that these trade reviewers are not teenagers. They're not middle schoolers. They're not in elementary school. Like, they're not our target audience. And so like Johnny was saying earlier, even if you do get a starred review, if you get a negative review from them, like all of it, just take it with a grain of salt, because that's not really who you're writing for in the first place.
Yeah. Super. Just exactly what you two said. I think that like, we could probably go on all day about just like the people who like are exactly who we meant for this book to reach, like reaching them, and then those kids telling us like what it meant to them to be seen for maybe the first time in their lives, or to read something that's like their new favorite book. Like, nothing is going to ever beat that feeling. You know, you can get 1,000 star reviews and it's still going to mean nothing compared to like a 17-year-old queer Mexican kid telling me that they really loved my book. Like, that's just like, it's apples and oranges at that point. And like, we're all here for the orange juice. Like,
oh yeah. Yeah.
It is ultimately. But yeah, I think it's a great thing to touch on.
Yeah, it just melts your heart away when you hear that young voice or see that young writing. And it's like, oh, just, it really reaches into you. So I like it.
Yeah, I fully spend a whole afternoon just crying under my bed. Like, on the opposite end of like this trade review favorite sort of scenario, have you ever gotten a review that just like really, and I think to y'all's point of like, these people, like a lot of them are librarians or educators, but like, they're definitely not our target audience. And like, with that comes the opportunity for them to just not at all understand what you're getting, not at all like getting the point of your book, or just missing it whenever they write their reviews. And especially as marginalized writers, as Latina writers, like trade reviewers can show obvious unawareness of our cultures, and just even more so like a complete acknowledgement of like, I don't want to learn about your culture either, and I don't need it in a book. Which leads to even just very blatant racism and prejudice. And it's something that has been seen pretty frequently, even recently. And so I think it's important for like listeners to know, especially Latino writers, like, again, as we say, like, trade reviews aren't everything. If they miss the point of your book, like, that's it. It happens. It can happen. It can happen with librarians who are with SLJ, and it can happen with your intended audience. And it's just part of putting out a book and knowing that it's not going to reach everyone. But at the same time, when it comes to professional trade reviewers, like, so I think we have a right to expect a certain level of professionalism when it comes to those kinds of people, and a certain level of empathy when it comes to reading from perspectives that aren't familiar to y'all. And now I'm just kind of talking, but like, again, have y'all ever had that certain experience? I'm gonna guess Terry hasn't, because her one review was a star review. But like, otherwise, like, have y'all gotten a more professional even review that just like did not do it?
Just me. So it's not necessarily that they missed the point. You know, this is something that, like you were saying, Johnny, that most marginalized writers have to deal with at some point. You would think that these professional publications would do a better job of catching problematic language and bias and racism and all of these things before they hit print, but they're actually really bad at it, like to the point that sometimes it's pretty egregious. And something I've noticed a lot in reviews for Somewhere Between Bitter and Sweet from both professional trade reviewers and some not, is referring to Xander's character as being illegal or an illegal alien or illegal immigrant. And, you know, it's really offensive. No human being is illegal. Xander is undocumented. And it says that in the back jacket summary. Even if you didn't actually read the book, the language is there for you to pull from. I've also seen a lot of trade reviewers refer to the characters as Hispanic, which, you know, a lot of people consider to be a really outdated term that many of us do not use, and that some of us never used because it did not originate from within our community. It's a term that was created by the US government, and it prioritizes our relationship to Spain, who were our oppressors. And for that reason, many people find it harmful. And so it's just not something I would use to talk about a book that is meant to be a celebration of Latinidad. And so it's the diction in these reviews. It's the words that they choose out of, you know, a myriad of options they have. They go straight for the word that is the most harmful or the most problematic. And then, of course, I've gotten reviews that say the book is preachy or that it has an agenda to make white people look bad. You know, basically reviews from people who wanted me to center whiteness and then got mad when I didn't. But honestly, it's the same kind of microaggressions that Latina people experience just as they're moving through the world on a daily basis. So it was never a shock. But as you were saying earlier, you would think that these publications would have higher standards and higher expectations for themselves and their reviewers, and that they know, knowing that this is a problem, because this is, you know, popped off on Twitter several times, that they would have more eyes on these reviews before they go out to the world, that they would just simply Google a list of what are common microaggressions or problematic language that is targeted towards this particular marginalized community, and then just scan that review. They're not very long and pull out what is clearly problematic, but it seems like they just don't have an internal process for this. And so because of that, there is a lot of room for people to be harmed.
We leave our words up to like people who may or may not like our work. And ultimately, why are we, I think, really push, like, take these words from trade reviews with a grain of salt, like, as you should. At the same time, they do have an effect on educators and on librarians and on teachers and on booksellers and book and bookstore owners. And I think it's important that, like, while we, like, can brush off things that aren't necessarily, like, the best words about our books, it's important to also consider, like, how there's a lack of equity within trade reviewers and trade journals, especially as it pertains to non-white authors, and like the way that we're kind of set up a little bit behind, because, you know, we have to navigate a world that has existed on white-centered stories, and like, how do we push our story that is very much centered, not even on, I always say not even on Latinaness, but on like on Mexicanness, on Mexican Americanness, on Cuban Americanness, on like very specific to where it's like, these aren't Latina stories. These are specific to our own identities. That is even more specific than just raised south of Texas or south of Oklahoma, or, you know, like in a way that is brand new to a lot of people who are in charge of getting our stories in their own words to important people. So like it's definitely something that you have to juggle with and try not to think too hard about it ultimately, but like, you know, we just, at the end of the day, we can only put it in our best and hope that it reaches the people who we envision it reaching. Thank you to Terry and Alda and Lakin for joining me in this talk about ARCs and trade journals and reviews and all that sort of stuff. And if you'd like to learn more about Las Musas or our books, please visit our website at lasmusasbooks.com or find us on social media at Las Musas Books. And be sure to check out our bookshop page, where each purchase of one of our books goes towards supporting independent bookstores. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast. You can also sign up for the Las Musas newsletter to have podcast updates, as well as other Musa news, such as release dates, teasers, spotlights, and more, delivered straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening.